Yud Aleph Shavat, Thursday the 6th of February, Rabbi Shlomi Wise. Common Kashrus questions.
All in half an hour.
Morning,
everyone. In the past, when I've spoken here, I've tried to take one topic and cram it into half an hour. I decided this time, when I was asked to speak, to just give a bit of Q&A, I guess, and quickly ask questions. And I'm sure we'll finish whatever time on time, but I don't have specific questions I want to get through. I'm going to start, before I actually get to specific questions that are asked, I want to talk about asking questions. So this isn't officially my role, but more and more I'm getting questions from which are passed on to me from the public about different products. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, the three points which I think people need to think about before asking a question. First of all, in terms of who you're asking the question to. So, when it comes to a technical question, when it comes to a product, then the correct people to ask the question to are actually kashrus authorities. The reason for that is because they will hopefully have the technical knowledge about various products in terms of the manufacturing process, in terms of ingredients or hidden ingredients that might be in the product. On the other hand, when it comes to shall we say minhag or halacha, really the truth is one should go to one's own rov. And it's a little bit concerning how many people the KLBD, the office I work for, tell people they should speak to their, really the question should be addressed to their local Orthodox rabbi, whoever, their posuk, whoever that is. And it's actually concerning how many people, so certainly the younger people, maybe people who have come back from Eretz Yisrael, don't actually have a rov that they go to with these sort of questions. Just to give an example of something that came, that was asked to me not long ago, was a Frum fellow from the Gold's Green community. He wanted to know, he's someone who doesn't have non-Cholav Yisrael products. He wanted to know, in terms of shared equipment with Cholav Akum, what his take should be. So in other words, how far do you take it? Do you say that, okay, I only want to have a Cholav Yisrael chocolate or whatever it may be. What about if the line is shared with a non-Cholav Yisrael product, which might be the case. You might be doing a pyre of a chocolate on a line with and then if the kashering is not so thorough, what's his stance? I said to him, really, again, that's a question, you know, I can tell you all the different opinions in halacha and everything, but it's not for me to tell you what you should do. That's either you have a family minhag, hopefully, you have a father or a grandfather or someone to ask that question to, or you speak to your rov, but it's amazing. So there's a type of question that needs to be asked, and who you ask it to. The second thing is that nowadays, certainly the last 5 years, the types of questions that are being asked are getting more and more strange, but in two ways. You get people today who come, again, I suspect a lot of it's from people who come back from Eretz Yisrael, and now they want to start taking on a range of new chumras, and they start asking some very strange questions that were never asked before. A classic one, which it maybe isn't so strange, but I don't think people realize what they're asking, is chadosh. I'm constantly bombarded with questions about chadosh. This was when I was growing up here, this was almost unheard of, pretty much. And certainly, I don't think people realize just how far it goes, because they start asking about certain products. But I was speaking to one of the dayanim, and I pointed out, someone who really wants to be machmir for even Sofek chadosh, in other words, going beyond what the Shulchan Aruch demands, you know, that's wonderful for him, but the truth is that something like glucose syrup is about 50% of the time derived from wheat, and it can be coming from Europe, it can be coming from sources, you've got no idea where it's coming from. That's just one classic one. You go look in the processed foods, how many of them have glucose in them. And then there's many other ingredients that can come from wheat or other grain. And the truth is, you're going to have to very seriously limit your diet. If that's what you want to do, just understand that that is what you're planning to do. You know, there's a certain consistency. It's no good saying, well, the oat bran or the porridge oats that I'm having, I want to make sure are yoshon, definitely. But everything else, not a problem. Generally speaking, there is a machlokes haposkim about this. If I remember correctly, it's the Bach and the Pri Chodosh, I think, who have machlokes about Chodosh. The normal understanding is that Chodosh is a davar sheyesh lo matirin. It's something which will eventually become allowed. Now you just wait for Pesach and this product becomes allowed. And therefore, a davar sheyesh lo matirin doesn't have bittul at all, meaning it's not bottle in elef at all. So you can't say it's bottle b'shishim with something like chadash. If you are going to take it to the extent that you want to be makpid for even selling chadash, you're going to have, as I say, you're going to have a very limited diet. You basically avoid much, if not all, processed foods. The truth is, just in general, in terms of chumrah, I find that people are. It's become sort of fashionable to be machmir, very much so in kashrus. Not so much Hilchos Shabbos or Shmir Saloshin or many other very important Hilchos Stoka, Shmir Sinayim, Kibud Av Va'Em. I mean, I could literally start listing out all the, you know, some of the classes. Aseres HaDibros, you know, make sure you don't steal, even a pruta. I don't hear people pushing for that. I find people pushing for kashrus, and
so
I will.
Kashrus are
easy. So I'm not chas v'shalom saying that people shouldn't take on stringency. By the way, I'm talking stringency above and beyond what the halacha mandates. I'm not talking about keeping halacha l'katchila. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about going way beyond something that I'll give you just an example of what I'm talking about. There's an ingredient called tartaric acid. Tartaric acid is derived from usually the leftovers, the dregs of wine production, which stick to barrels and etc. and sometimes pits, and they harden, and very often they can harden for 12 months, they've dried out. They then take this stuff, which isn't really edible, mix it with sulfuric, react it with sulfuric acid. Doesn't sound very tasty to me. And it's used as an ingredient. Now, the Shulchan Aruch talks about this, and the Shulchan Aruch bringing a Rashba allows this. Shulchan Aruch allows it. There are some of the Nosekalim who are not so happy. But when you're talking about something which, as I say, is that's the dregs, not tartaric acid. The Shulchan Aruch is talking about the leftover dregs. You're not talking about when you've reacted with sulfuric acid. When you're talking about something like that, and you're talking about something that has bittul, and it's done by a non-Jewish company, so. You know, what's the tzatz? I couldn't understand. This is a short. I mean, as far as I understood, all kashrus agencies have used this and approved this in the past. Then I was informed that about 5 or so years ago, the Chinese found a way of making synthetic tartaric acid. Which, okay, it's not easy. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be hard to get hold of. And certainly, there isn't a global market for it. So I had a question. Someone said to me, what is the KLD policy? And da 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 da, you know. I didn't even know where he was coming from until I looked into it. So he wants to be machmir beyond the Shulchan Aruch, which is his prerogative, but I would say that, again, you're going to start checking through all your items. Until a few years ago, the most machmir kashrus agency in the world would have allowed this without question. Now, there's another option which is difficult to get hold of, and it's very hard to go and tell all your companies start changing to synthetic acid, which many of them don't want to have that on their products, etc. So, again, it's something for them to think on. The reason I say this is there's a Gemara in Chulin, which some of you may know. It's Daf Kuf Hei, and it talks a story about Mar Ukva. Mar Ukva says about himself that he is Chala ben Chamra, compared to his father. He's sort of vinegar, the son of wine. Why? Because his father wouldn't eat, after he'd eaten meat, he wouldn't eat milk for 24 hours. He says, Ki Hashta, he would wait till the next day, so he's waiting for one. And he says, I only wait till the next Suda. Right, and that's the famous question of what does it mean the next Suda. Tosfos says it pretty much can be straight away, you don't have to wait. Then we have some people minhag for 6 hours, etc., etc. Just parenthetically, Agav, I'll mention that I have, there's a particular sefer, I won't mention by name, quite a well-known sefer on Basar Cholov, which wrote that the minhag of 3 hours is a wrong minhag and it doesn't have a source. I was quite shocked to see this because when I read it originally, because you know, it doesn't take a lot of research. You look in the Daki Chuvah, he brings you two makoros. One of them is from the kuntres at the back of Raveni Yerucham, the kuntres of a heter, and that's it's miyuchas l'Rashi. Probably wasn't Rashi, but even if it It's certainly one of the Ashkenazi Rishonim. So there's a solid source for such a thing. To go and write a sefer and publish it and say there's no makom for such a thing when you're basically trashing the minhag of many from Yidden, I'm not sure what he was thinking. And this is quite a well-known sefer, but there you are. So there's different minhagim about this. Baruchva says, I'm vinegar, the son of wine, because I only keep to the next Suda. Well, the question is obvious. Maruchva was one of them, was the Rosh Gola in Bavel. He was one of the great Amoraim, right? How difficult would it have been for Maruchva to be Machme, like his father, to do 24 hours? We're not talking about some, ordinary person. I mean, one of the most famous stories about Maruchva is the story in Ksubas about when he used to secretly give tzedakah, and one time he was coming late back from the yeshiva, his wife went to meet him, he was late, and he went to this house to go and drop off the money secretly by this poor person. Poor person wants to see who's giving him this money and chases after him. They end up running into an oven that was had been used, was boiling hot, and they did this not to embarrass this poor person. They shouldn't see who's delivering the tzedakah to him. And that's the famous story that Maruchva's feet gets burned. So he either, as a machlokas, whether he risked his life by doing this or if it was just very painful, but clearly someone of that caliber is no difficulty. You know, if you're willing to risk your health by burning your feet in an oven, waiting 24 hours is nothing. So the poskim, Beretz Mefarsh and the Chida and others, I originally saw this in Rav Zevin's Sefer Al HaTorah and Parshas Yisro, he says that you can't always, in other words, they explain, had Maruchva, it wasn't the case that Maruchva felt that because he wasn't doing this, he wasn't as great as his father. It was the other way around. He felt he wasn't as great as his father, and therefore it wasn't appropriate for him to do this chumrah. What does that mean? That means that had he been doing it, he wouldn't have been doing it as an outgrowth, a natural consequence of his level in ruchnius. He would have been doing an action. Okay, he's physically copying. Rav Zevin used the lashon actually ma'aseh kof. It would have been like acting like a monkey. Monkey see, monkey do. He's just mimicking his father's behavior. But his father was being more machmir than the halacha needed, necessitated, because that was who his father was. So he's saying that is it's a siman, not a sibba, shall we say? It's a reason. It shows you the status of the person. And there are actually posts we discussed this, whether it's appropriate. I think the Ben Shchayim Torah Shmot discussed, is it appropriate for a person to go mimachma? Once a person decides, ooh, I like this Gemara, I want to keep 24 hours after meat, which, good luck, but if you do, so they break down. Even Arizal didn't do that, right? Arizal was quite machma, he would wait maybe 12 hours, he would wait till nighttime. Fine, but in other words, sometimes one has to take chumras within the context. Obviously, I'm not Chas v'Shalom suggesting to that people rest on their laurels or take things easy. We're all interested in growing and steiging, but it has to be done in the correct way. You can't just sort of pick and choose your chumras. And I think one of the ways that illustrates this is when people start to pick chumras in kashrus, but in many other areas they're not really holding. If anything, it can be a case of it's sort of almost like sheichat. Your yetzahara makes you feel like, oh, you're machmeh on. Oh, I only eat this, I only eat that. Right? But other things, how long are you spending learning Torah every day? How's your ben on chaveri? How's your shmir Shabbos, etc. Other crucial things, maybe we don't take as seriously. The other side of the coin is obviously people who sort of have this attitude: why can't more things be kosher? Why do you seem to be strict on this and that and the other? And everything's a no, no, no. So just to give a little bit of background, something that people don't necessarily know. People talk about America. People have gone to America. You can go to the supermarket and many products. I haven't seen the percentage, but quite a large percentage of products have a hechsher. And everyone wonders why that is. The truth is that's got nothing to do with Yidden. So when I do Jewish people, it may seem strange that when I tell this to people, and they haven't heard this before, they think it's quite strange. Only about 8% of the market in America that buys kosher food are doing it for religious reasons because of kashrus. Now 92% of the people there are non-Jewish people very often, and they're not buying it for religious reasons at all. Right? I saw a report from about 2013, an Albany law professor called Timothy Lighton, I think that's his name, and he did research on this. He's written some books. He points out that the American market for kosher food is something like $12 billion a year. This is going back again, that's the figures from 2013. And there's about roughly over 12 million people buying kosher food specifically. The reason for that is because the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in America, is both vastly underfunded and also has had quite a number of quite a lot of corruption in its past. And when it comes to the food side of things, it's quite behind in terms of auditing factories, etc. And unfortunately, the food market in America, the standards, the health and safety standards, are way behind Europe. And in fact, when they had this whole Brexit thing, and they're talking about chlorine chickens, etc., that's the tip of the iceberg. The truth is that, some of the factories in America are shocking to see in terms of health and safety, etc., and quality checks and things like that. And already in the sort of the 1930s, 1940s, companies in America, big companies who got kosher certification for whatever reason, actually started using that themselves, self-branding. They started putting out adverts in the newspapers saying kosher is clean, and kosher is healthy, kosher is good. I mean, anyone who's gone to a kosher restaurant and looked what's behind the counter, I'm not sure they would agree that kosher is clean, etc. But this is what, this became a marketing campaign which ran for quite a while. And that's why in Americans' eyes, when they go to the shops, they associate kosher. Many do, not all, many do. And it's amazing how what's only about 3% or 4% of the market share can actually influence the whole market. And now, Baruch Hashem, lucky for the Americans, they have huge amounts of kosher food available. What's maybe the irony is that in Europe, where there are much stricter regulations in terms of food manufacture, the irony is that they don't need or don't want kosher because they don't need it. They don't feel they need it unless they're exporting to America, North America, or Eretz Yisrael. Mostly, that's what it is. It's not for the local market. The local market doesn't feel the need for it. There's nothing. Now, every so often, you have some sort of scandal in terms of something that happens in the food industry. Usually, that's coming from outside Europe, almost always. But it comes into Europe, so it affects Europe. But when it does happen, they make a whole big deal out of it. It's unlike in America, that's, they say, a dime a dollar. It's almost every day that's what things happening. So we are somewhat limited to what we can do. We obviously try to have as many products available, but it's not always possible. Okay, I want to go through a few items in terms of commonly asked questions of products. So one of them I've been getting a lot is Japanese whiskey. So people ask, what's the story of Japanese whiskey? The truth is, there isn't much of a story. It's very hard to say. It's very hard to quantify. It's very hard to give rules about Japanese whiskey. Scottish and Irish whiskey are regulated. I think, I don't know all the back ins and outs, but from what I understand, it's actually mostly the EU who clamped down and wanted to define various alcoholic drinks. So in 2008, the regulation from the EU, I've got all the numbers, and if anyone cares about this sort of things, but he describes whiskey, what it must contain, the percentage of volume minimum in terms of alcohol, in terms of it has to be 3 years old, wooden casks, etc., etc., as a whole thing, and what ingredients can go in or processing aids. So really the only thing other than malt, water, yeast, that sort of thing is plain caramel for colouring. That's the only thing that goes in. So when you've got, the only question that has now become recently is the casks that are used in terms of kashrus, which isn't, the EU is not really bothered about. But in terms of Japanese whiskey, there isn't really any regulation whatsoever what can go in. They could literally put in anything they like. In fact, that's what they do, because the fact is they've got no heritage. They've got nothing, they've got no name or history to base themselves on. Their distilleries are not from 1788 or whatever. And they don't have this heritage of the Isla, Pete, and whatever, and all the sprach you have at the back of these cartons. So they try to improve the product. They're not limited to this. And they try and do various things to make the product as good as possible. And when you're not limited in the tricks you can use, so you're not limited. So there you go, to do what you like. Now, I'm not saying that Japanese whiskey is not kosher, but the answer is it's a big question mark. That's the real truth. Unless, I'm not sure why the American agencies haven't sort of put their foot down about this. I think there would be more of a market on their back if they would want it to be kosher certified. There's a question, really, if Scottish and Irish whiskey needs to be kosher certified, leaving aside any casks anyway. But, you know, that's again being pushed by Israel and other places who want Hechshon whiskey. But in terms of Japanese whiskey, there isn't really any regulation in place what goes into it. And we know that, you know, for example, in Canada, in their bourbon, they now, it's become a thing that they add wine, actual wine, not just casks. They actually add wine into a lot of the bourbons. And this can very easily happen in Japan as well. So at this time, it's not a question of saying Japanese whiskey is osa, but it's also not saying that Japanese whiskey is muta. We don't really know. It may be if you get a specific information, it may be okay. Okay, one of the things that came up recently is brown sugar. There's actually a shortage, a global shortage of sugar. This is coming up, getting calls from Eretz Yisrael. For things like brown sugar, which very often doesn't have a heksher for Pesach, and everyone wants it, and okay, it's a whole story. Tesco brown sugar was approved by KLW until recently. One of the main things about it, when we're not talking about Pesach, is whether it uses glycerol or glycerine as a humectant, which is basically that is used as a little bit of fat, which is used to draw in the moisture, because as you know, soft brown sugar is you know, can clump a lot easier. You end up with a ruined product, unlike your white sugar, which also can clump, but it's not as quick. And that can be from animal fat. There isn't really there was a shock in the 1990s where British sugar was found to have animal glycerine, I believe, and that was a bit of a problem. It can be more than shishin. So it's something that one would have to worry about. So Tesco obviously don't have their own sugar manufacturer. They get from suppliers, but now they change to a supplier, whoever that supplier is, who puts glycerol in their brown sugar. Now, although they claim to be vegetarian, that is not regulated very strictly, and therefore, in terms of approval, the Tesco sugar no longer became approved. You can find, I mean, Tate & Lyle sugar, you'll see on the ingredients, there is no glycerol included, and it's fine. But obviously people want cheaper alternatives when possible. But at least in the long term, certainly I would suggest that minimally make sure there aren't any additives such as glycerol in your brown sugar, or get one with a heksher. Recently... Sorry?
What makes it brown?
That's usually colouring from something like molasses. So very often, funnily enough, people assume it's been less refined, and that's not the way it is. It's a cholent sort of. But basically, you take refined sugar, which is clear, and then you add back in the colour. When you take sugar cane or even sugar beet, it's not white, right? You have to actually use chemicals to get the colouring out, and they do that, but then they put it back in for the brown stuff. So it ends up being a mixture of that can be of various sugar syrup, various lines, and you then you make a balance, you know, you balance it out, and then you crystallize it. Some of those, in terms of Pesach, depending on how machmir you want to be, sometimes when you take sucrose and you split it, use an enzyme to do that. Certainly the cheaper way of doing it is using an enzyme, and those enzymes can be chometz. They're grown on chometz glucose, etc. And again, how far you take this in halacha, again, now, I should have added earlier that together with a trend in being more machmir by people, that has a knock-on effect to kashrus agencies, and each one is helping the other to be more and more machmir as time goes on, where the kashrus agency wants to show that it takes kashrus very seriously, etc. So I'm not sure who's in more competition than who in terms of chumras. I know certain rabbonim, I won't mention my name, I know a lot of rabbonim who are bemoaning that they're getting, as I say, from both sides, they get people who claim they're being too strict, and then they get people pushing chumra every new chumra of the week. So it's a very unfortunate situation to be stuck in the middle where you're trying to balance it out, but that's what it is. So these things, in terms of, let's say, a chometz enzyme, again, most kosher agencies won't give a kosher Pesach, as far as I know, they won't give a kosher Pesach hechsher on a product that has a enzyme used to in the process, even though it's bottle in millions, but because of the effect it has in a process, it's not just sort of an ingredient. So, as I say, that's just by the side. Sorry? I would agree with you. But kashrus agencies in general, at least the standard kashrus agencies, don't rely on bittul. As a rule, don't rely on bittul. And in an emergency situation, depending on what it is, maybe. But generally speaking, they don't rely on bittul of milk in parov or treif in kosher or chametz in even before Pesach. I mean, why that is, you could ask. We generally paskin the Ashkenazim and Sfardim. We paskin that we don't hold a chayz of a neir and lach b'lach, right? When it's bottle before Pesach, it's only yovish b'yovish, right? The Shulchan Aruch is the most makel. Ramah is a bit more machmir. The most machmir is the Rambam. And interestingly enough, I understand that Rav Machpud in Eretz Yisrael, who really is a Yemenite, is actually very machmir when it comes to Pesach, because according to the Rambam, even lach b'lach before Pesach would be chayz of a neir on Pesach. So, as I say, okay, these are. I only have a few minutes left, so I'll just go through a few more. Recently, I don't know if anyone saw, there was a story about honey. Tesco set honey was recalled. They found that it wasn't pure honey, and it was mixed with some sort of sugar syrup of sorts. Wasn't glucose, it was sugar syrup, apparently. That's close enough, yeah. I think really this has started happening because China has, in the last few years, really grown in the honey market. And I think what was once a very basic product, maybe we have to be a bit more careful about now. That basically, in certain countries, such as America, there's something called colony collapse disorder, where basically a lot of bees are dying out, a lot of entire colonies are. Some of it's to do with the growth of almonds, because they're using a lot more almond milk products being used now for people who are lactose intolerant, and the bees don't seem to like that. So anyway, China, as they do, like to fill a hole in the market, and they've really gotten into honey. And unfortunately, with that comes a lack of checks, as they should be. But major suppliers of honey are buying in from all over the world. They're also buying from China, and I would suspect in this case that would be something like that. Normally speaking, it's not going to be, KLD hasn't issued an alert because generally speaking, it's not going to be a treif thing that's going to be adulterated. It may start to be a problem in terms of Pesach to make sure that your honey is pure honey and has no chametz shaydus. For example, if it would be, as you say, glucose, that would be a genuine chametz on Pesach problem. So for the moment, I would stick with reputable sellers of honey. One of the questions that comes up is to do with chocolate. In 2014, they did some tests in Malaysia and found in Mondelez, which is the company that does Cadbury's, they found some pig DNA in a couple of their chocolate bars. There was a whole back and forth about this, whether the test was correct or was a false positive, whatever it was. But you can imagine that the people there went a little bit over the top, and some calling for a jihad against the company. And one of the things about chocolate is that I heard that a Rav had said that the way chocolate is kashered, it's very difficult to kasher chocolate equipment. Usually something like oil is used. It doesn't like water, so they use shah mashkim to kasher, which is a bit of a kula, although it's heta, usually not kashering from treif. But many hechsherim will only give a parav of hechsher to something that has dedicated equipment to parav, so they won't kasher at all. So for example, the Starkey, I don't know if you've seen the Schneider's chocolates, the Starkey from Baltimore, they told me they won't give a hechsher to something that has dairy. They have to be very careful about this, because some people rely on parav as a in terms of lactose intolerance. Especially in America, they see parav, people who are lactose intolerant are very careful. They know, okay, I can eat that. So I know the Bendix chocolates are a dedicated line to Paro only. There's no dairy going on there. There was a case of a woman who was actually in a restaurant here in London, and she'd had a Fleischig meal, and then she had ice cream, and she had a super hyper intolerance to lactose, and she started going into anaphylactic shock. And luckily she had an EpiPen with her, and it was okay, but what turned out was it was the chocolate chips, which had maybe a few parts per million of lacto or dairy in them, and she went into anaphylactic shock just from something so small as that. Because she's so sensitive, she, Baruch Hashem, had an EpiPen with her, and it was fine. But that was a Hechsher from America who'd given, probably in Halacha, there was what to rely on to give it a power of status, but Lamaise had a minor crossover, and I think generally speaking, when you have shared equipment like that, the kashrus agencies usually put D. Even you look on the ingredients, there's no D, there's no dairy in it, but there may be a dairy allergen warning, but they'll have a D.
It's use these people as a test, then, isn't it?
Human experimentation, I don't suggest you. Okay, the final one I'll mention is granola bars, which is something that comes up all the time. There is basically the process for granola bars is that you take oats, you steam them for a very short period of time, and you then roll them between massive rollers, flatten them, and then bake them. So I should add, the husk is taken off first. So this is a very big machlokes, what bracha to make on granola bars. I find it very difficult to understand why someone would think that's mazonis. I would say, I mean, it's not for me to make a psak, I'm not paskening for anyone, but it seems to be hadama. There are those who want to say that softening with a bit of steam, even for a short period of time, already changes it to mazonis. But it's not really cooked or broken down, it's really baked from raw, pretty much. And therefore, many people will say it's hadama. If it is mazon, because of sofek, many people will tell you to have it during a meal only, which kind of defeats the whole purpose. If you're having a granola bar, the whole point is you're not sitting down for a meal, you want a snack on the go. So I think that's a bit funny. I mean, you're going to take, or the alternative would be take a bit of cake and take a bit of something hadama and eat it. It's not practical. So again, this is a question really more for one's own local Orthodox rabbi to ask what the bracha is. I think the consensus is mostly hadama, but there are those who are machme and are concerned it might be mazonis. Someone can ask their rabbi.
Thank you.